Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, AWM Program Director Allison Sansoni chats with best-selling author Elizabeth Berg about her recent memoir, I'll Be Seeing You, a beautifully written, poignant love story of caring for her parents in their final years. This conversation originally took place November 16th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thank you, everyone, for being here with us tonight. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. And we're here tonight with Elizabeth Berg, who is the author of the new book, I'll Be Seeing You, a chronicle of the aging of her parents alongside the remarkable story of their love for each other and for their family. She's the author of more than two dozen books, including Open House and Oprah's Book Club selection and Joy School, one of the ALA's best books for young adults. In 2018, she was awarded the State of Illinois Literary Heritage Award for her extraordinary contributions to our literary culture. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Oh, thank you for being here. I wanted to ask a question I always ask memoirists when they've published their books is, why now? Why did you choose to bring the story of your parents forward in this moment?
When my parents got to the age where things started happening, my dad got Alzheimer's, and they were really forced to leave the house where they had lived for so long. It was heartbreaking and it was infuriating and it was confusing, and I needed, as a writer, to write out all those things I was feeling. I did not intend to publish a book about all this. It's just that I needed to see where I was, so to speak. And one of the things that really helps me if I'm ever going through anything is to hear other people's stories about it. So after everything was over, it occurred to me that if I were to publish this kind of journal that I kept, it might help others. And judging from the response that I've seen thus far, it really has. And that's been really gratifying.
When the book begins, your father's beginning to both forget things and to become frustrated by that forgetfulness and to deny it. What is the role of memory in this book, and how did you negotiate yours and your siblings and your parents in order to create the narrative?
That's a very sophisticated question that presupposes a lot of things I wasn't aware of, really. The book is really my telling the story as it happened. And I was so struck by the poignancy, sometimes by the humor. My father got paranoid when he first started showing symptoms of Alzheimer's. And one of the things, this is an example of both the humor and the poignancy of things that happened. One of the things that happened is he said to my mother, "We don't get along the way we used to. Are you seeing someone?" And, you know, it was kind of funny, but it was also sort of heartbreaking. And he thought that people were coming to sit in his car. And he thought that people were looking in the windows. These are very common things that happen to people with Alzheimer's. And I guess what I want my book to serve as is a don't do what I did type of thing in some respects. I think I did some things well, but I think I made a lot of mistakes. One of those mistakes was in trying to convince my dad of what was real and what wasn't. That just doesn't work. He didn't see it that way anymore. Logic was not the same for him. Reality was not the same. For me to say there's no one looking in your windows was to belie everything he knew and believed about his own situation. So one thing I learned to do is just roll with it a little. And when he would say, "Would you like a glass of wine?" 95 times. 95 times I would say, "No, thanks, I'm fine." Or, well, not 95 times, "Yes, I will." But I was figuring it out as I went along, not only my own reactions to what was happening, but my relationship with my sister, with my brother, with my mother, with my father. It was very interesting how I kind of took sides. In the beginning, I felt like I needed to defend my mother against my father, who was not cooperating with moving and so on. Then it became a situation where I was defending my father against my mother. It's a journey.
Yeah, and it's a journey that, you know, I think a lot of people probably watching along are, you know, familiar with or will become so, unfortunately, in that, you know, when you mentioned the things that sort of become stuck in someone's mind. My grandmother lived to 91, and toward the end, she always had to have a cookie at a particular time. And so she would ask us over and over, you know, is my cookie there? On top, you know, on top of the refrigerator. Is it there? Is it there? And we would consistently reassure her that yes, it's there. But yeah. That was the, you know, that was the issue, was, you know, what sticks with you in those moments. And so listening to, you know, to your father, you know, ask the same questions over and over. I mean, did he ever bring up anything that you were unaware of that would surprise you?
No. Short answer.
Yeah. Parents and children create such different stories about their own families. How did you find when you were writing this book that the story that you thought you were going to write was the same as the one that you ended up telling?
Again, I didn't think of it in terms of writing a book and publishing it. I was just trying to deal with my own emotions and also to have a record of what was happening. Things changed so much. For example, my parents agreed together to move to a place that my sister and I found for them. And we were so relieved, my sister and I, thinking at last they're going to be in a place that's a little safer. It's all on one level. There's good coffee in the dining room. And then abruptly, my father changed his mind. And that was a delicate point for me, because I had to tell my mom, you're going to have to be the one that makes the decisions now. He's not capable. He's not able to say something and commit to it and understand all that comes along with that. He thought of the place where they moved to eventually as a hotel, and asked my mother one night, do they change the towels in this hotel? So nonetheless, there were moments of great beauty and clarity and poignancy and love. I think if you're lucky enough to have your parents get old enough that they need help, you inadvertently sign up for a lot of things that you might not have imagined. But it was, when I look back on it now, it was a privilege. And my parents did have an extraordinary love story, and I bore witness to that my whole growing up life. My mother was my father's North Star, his best friend, his true love, the one he wanted to please more than anyone. I grew up hearing him say, "Where's your mother?" He always needed to know where she was. For him to be put in a position where he was no longer able to take care of her, to have their roles reversed, was difficult. I think he had an awareness of that and tried in his way to take care of her anyway. For example, after they moved, he had a scooter that he rode around on, and he would ride the scooter to the front door and leave it there so that no one could get in. And he had moments of lucidity. He said to me at one point, "I just feel like I'm in a fog." And I said, "Do you?" And that's all he could say about it. But, you know, this taught me that there are always those moments of illumination and beauty and joy, even in the hardest of situations. And you have to make it up as you go along and you have to get through it. And I'm struck, by the way, at how their situation parallels the situation so that we are all in now. We're on unfamiliar terrain, terrifying terrain. We're in the middle of it. We're coping as best we can. We don't know how or when it's going to end. So we have come in this time, I think, to appreciate things more. And that's the good part of it. We know now how valuable our friendships are, how great it is to call a friend and say, hey, you want to meet over at this restaurant and have a drink? It just to hug someone, you know, these things that we took for granted. Same thing in this journey with my parents, the things that I took for granted and then only realized their worth when they were gone. But you still have something.
Yeah. What was their love story when they were young? How did they meet and how did they come to fall in love?
They met at the back of a dime store by the parakeets. And my father, who was a lifer in the military, he was in the army. He was home on leave and he asked my mother to go out, and they went horseback riding, which is so not something that my mother would have liked to have done, but she did it anyway.
That's a tough first date.
Yeah. And she said, oh, he just kept chasing some blonde who was out there riding that day, which is the only time I've ever heard about my father being anything less than besotted by his wife. But that was their first date. And then he went off to World War II and they exchanged letters, of course. And my father was on board ship. His duty was to ferry goods and supplies back and forth on the ship. He wasn't in the Navy, but he was the Army guy who guarded things. He got a letter from my mother one day. They had mail call on the deck of the ship and the letter blew out of his hand and he jumped in the ocean to retrieve it. That's how much he loved her and her letters. And I asked him many, many, many years later, why did you do that? And he said, I didn't think about it. I mean, he wanted the letter. And I said, well, wasn't that dangerous? And he said, yeah, I guess it was. But he did it. And then when my dad was stationed in Texas in 1943. In January, my mom took a train to the base where he was stationed to marry him. And her maid of honor was a lieutenant, some guy in the army. My grandmother did not like my father. And what she told my mother was, he has too much hair. I don't know. I guess that's all she could come up with. But you know, my mother, in you know, defiantly, and I think she was probably usually a good girl, but nope, this was her guy, and she got on the train and went and married him. And then she lived the life of an army wife until he retired in 1966. So my siblings and I were brought up as army brats, you know, moving every 10 minutes. And when he was retiring from the service, she wanted to go home, as she called it, which was Minnesota. So after all those years, that's where she ended up, and she was where they ended up. And my mother was extraordinarily close to her sisters who lived in Minnesota, and they hung around in this pack together. And in this book, the six sisters are now three. And the one who drives is like the prom queen, you know, National Honor Society, most popular girl in the class, and that was my Aunt Tish. And And when she fell in a parking lot one day and broke her wrist, that was the end of Tish driving. So there was a lot that my mother was dealing with besides my father. A lot of hard things were happening. And I realized in watching her go through these things that she was much stronger than I ever knew.
You talk a little bit about in the beginning about the shifting dynamic between the two of them and about your mother asking your mother to make decisions when your father had been the one to do that. That's something that's very hard to do in a relationship as long established as theirs to change those roles. How did that affect their relationship?
You know, it just goes to show you. Because when my mother was, 89, I guess, my dad was 90, she had an epiphany, which was this. When he said, "Do we have those little sundaes in the freezer?" And she said, "Yes." It occurred to her to say, "If you want one, go and get one." Because all her life, she would jump up and go get stuff for him and serve him. So, you know, there you are. You only have to wait till you're 89 years old before you think, wait a minute, there could be a little more equality in this relationship.
That's amazing. I wanted to ask you, Elizabeth, what, you know, you said at the beginning of our talk here that, you know, you made mistakes, that you did things that now you would do differently. Do you think that there's a right way to negotiate these types of issues? And what would it be?
Empirically, but the trouble is that emotions get in the way. And of course, to say that there's a right way belies the fact that everybody's different. Everybody operates differently. Everybody responds to things differently. So maybe no, maybe there isn't a right way. But I think that if you come from a place of love, you don't mess up entirely, which is not to say that you don't have screaming arguments and moments of extreme frustration and feeling like one mistake I made is that just because you think something is obvious doesn't mean the other person does. And that the progress in these kinds of situations is not linear. You go forward a step and go back two sometimes. Patience is everything. I think it's good to express a lot of things before it gets to the boiling point. I think you need to expect that you're going to be surprised by some of the things that your parents want or say or do. And to try, it's a cliche, but to try as much as possible to take it a day at a time. That said, you do have to make plans at some point if the living situation for your parents is untenable. You have to take more of a role than you might be comfortable doing yourself. You have to parent them now.
And that can be very difficult to recognize, is that moment when that dynamic flips.
Yeah. And of course it's not a single moment. It's on a continuum. And it's people who say I lost my mother before I lost my mother. I really know what they mean now. You go for so long with this idea of who your parents are and what to expect from them. And then everything changes. Most things change, I should say.
Did you get them back through writing the book?
Yeah. Yeah. And also in living the experience. My dad was a really fierce presence. He was the unsmiling, tough-talking guy who scared the hell out of every guy I ever went out with in high school. And we came to understand each other. He became my guy. I was terrified of him And I never told him until my mid-30s that this didn't happen when he was so mightily compromised at the end. I was in my mid-30s, not my whatever I was in this book, late 60s. And once I told my dad that I was terrified of him and why, that I had been terrified all my life of him, it just broke a dam. It really helped. So that's, again, why I think that it can be helpful to get these things out before they get to be too big.
Did your parents talk about their past, your past as a family with their children? Was that something they did?
Honestly, not so much. We were not a close-knit family. I wasn't close to my sister. I wasn't close to my brother. I'm close to my sister now and much more to my brother than I was. But my brother lives in Hawaii, so he wasn't around for a lot of this. And I live in Chicago, and my sister lives in Minnesota, so I drove up there a lot, but she bore the brunt of most of this. But we were not a touchy-feely, talk-it-out kind of family. That's not the dynamic that we had. So that shaped my experience, of course.
In the writing of this book, did you learn anything as a writer from the experience of writing this particular book?
After the fact, I would say I was afraid to publish this book. I didn't know how it would be received, not only by my relatives, but by strangers. And what I learned after it was published is how much appreciation there is for being honest and exposing yourself in a way. I think it's helpful for people to know how I screwed up and for me to put it right in there. I mean, it is in there, the mistakes I made and the guilt I felt and the remorse. But again, also those moments that are such a triumph. I'll give you an example that has to do not with my parents, but that made me think of them. And that is that one night I wanted to go to the Chicago Symphony. And so I just jumped in the cab and went down there. And I was sitting very close to the stage, and in front of me was a couple probably in their 90s. Really frail, he more than she. But they were dressed up and they came out to the symphony. And when he had to stand up to let people go by him in the row, it was with such difficulty that he did that. When the concert was over, he unfolded his walker and he walked up the aisle, and it seemed to me that they were going an inch an hour. It was excruciatingly slow, but they did it. And I had such admiration and respect for them. And the love between them was absolutely apparent. When she rubbed the arm of his coat, when she helped him up the aisle, and as they were going up the aisle, the crowd was cheering for the performance. But in my head, I thought, they're cheering for this couple who's still in love, still bothers to come to the symphony. It seemed a moment of such sweet triumph to me. And that incident is in the book, as well as many other incidents that affected me that way.
And when people say for better or worse, in sickness and in health.
Yeah. I thought of that many times that, excuse me, when they got married and they said, oh yeah, 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 in sickness and health. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
They did it.
Yeah. You said you wanted to, there was a passage you wanted to read for us.
Oh, there is. And I'll tell you that it comes very near the end of the book, but that won't ruin it for you at all. I have a friend whose elderly mother lives with her and is driving her crazy. Her mother was once a talented artist and intellectual with myriad interests. Now, my friend says, she gets up in the morning and makes a cup of coffee, and she's so slow doing it. I mean, I just watch her sometimes to see how she can possibly be so slow. Then she sits at the kitchen table and talks about what might be for lunch. I just can't stand it. All she talks about is her cup of coffee in the morning and the weather and what her next meal will be. I really wonder, is there any meaning to the end of life? I suppose one way to answer that question is to think about how a baby's meaning in life is a ray of sunshine, the color red, the nearness of his mother's flesh. For a teenager, it is music, fitting in, hormone management. In midlife, meaning comes from focusing on our families, our jobs, our involvement with the world outside our kitchens, which is to say that the meaning of life is ever-changing, even as we are. Who's to say that the richest time of life might not be when a cup of morning coffee fills the world? If you found a holy man hidden away on a mountain who found fulfillment in such seemingly simple things, would you not admire him? It is a very warm summer morning, and my parents are both alive and ambulatory. They are still capable of enjoying a slice of apple pie and of having a conversation. They are living together in what will probably be the last home they will ever share. Imagine them at the breakfast table. I'm sorry, kitchen table. My mother will serve breakfast on the embroidered tablecloth. The day will pass. Laundry will be done. The mail will be gotten. The phone will be answered. People they pass in the hall will be acknowledged. Lunch and dinner will be eaten. Someone may drop by for a visit. In the evening, the television will be on and they will sit watching their shows. They will go to bed together. My father has never and will not now go to bed without my mother. And while the moon follows an ancient path across the night sky, they will lie next to each other with their eyes closed. In the morning, the first thing they see will be each other.
That's lovely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you very much for being here with us and for sharing so much of yourself in this book and with us here tonight, Elizabeth. Thank you.
And thanks thank to you everybody who came. Yeah, you were probably going to say that, but I just want everybody who's there to know I really appreciate your being there.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, editor Jennifer Minton Quigley discusses her recent anthology, Lolita in the Afterlife, on beauty, risk, and reckoning with the most indelible and shocking novel of the 20th century. Jennifer is joined by contributing writers Bindu Basanath, Alexander Heeman, and Laurie Lipman. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.